The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
That decision, because you always felt like if we lived in a society based on, not human greed or whatever, you know, where there was real, a safer society, she would be totally safe. So, you know, she wasn't a danger to herself. She wasn't a danger to the community. She definitely had issues with her bathroom, and like she couldn't, you know, there's like a lot of aluminum foil and she'd like taken out the plumbing. But like in a regular society, imagine socialist worlds or, you know, anything better than the crap we live with, you could see how that really wouldn't prevent someone from living in a community that doesn't, you know. So anyway, I think those are the ways where you can see where it's actually the society that creates the disability, that creates the need to send someone to a nursing home. Okay. So I want to make sure, as I move on, that we're rooting this whole discussion in how capitalism distorts and oppresses. While gender oppression tends to have more to do with maintaining privatized social reproduction, meaning taking the onus off capitalism to care for the workforce and other people, disability is the flip side, worthless and marginalized and oppressed as much as possible, because they're not seen as useful to the capitalist system. Now, the way these dynamics play out, especially when gender and disability intersect, are crucial to understand. And because when you fight gender oppression and disability oppression, you raise questions about the priorities of this brutal, unfair system. Okay, so a few historical moments to show this. Gender and disability categories were more overlapping or blurry than they are currently. And that's where, you know, when I was talking about the woman who was hanged for heresy. Going back to the social model, the fundamental relationship between ability to be a capitalist worker and being defined as disabled strikes me as a good way to start understanding these combined categories. Nielsen, in a disability history of the United States, writes of the post-revolutionary period, given that disability was defined as the inability to labor, white women, free African-American women, and slaves came to be associated with the disabled. Political theory linked the denial of property rights with the embodiment of supposed deficiencies. Mental impairments or differences were more or less disabling based on gender, race, and class. Same for physical impairments. Non-white folks were generally seen as mentally defective, but perfectly good for labor. As Baton writes about about immigration policy, quote, for the more controversial business of defining and excluding undesirable ethnic groups, however, restrictionists found the concept of disability to be a powerful tool. That is, while people with disabilities constituted a distinct category of persons unwelcome in the United States, the charge that certain ethnic groups were mentally and physically deficient was instrumental in arguing for their exclusion. Okay, I'm going to skip over that. So in the late 1800s and early 1900s was the growth of the eugenics movement, and during the fight, and this also was around the time of the fight for women's suffrage in this country. And I should have said this earlier, obviously I'm focusing on the United States. As I said, this is a very broad topic. Feel free to bring in and fill out all the other things happening in the world. So anyway, two arguments made against women's suffrage were that women were either too impaired mentally to handle full citizenship, or that women would be disabled by the overwhelming responsibility and challenge of becoming full citizens. Mm-hmm. I had to quote a lot of funny quotes about this to cut them, but just as the medical model defines the needs of people with disabilities today, it also defined women's roles as that way at this point in the early 20th century. Which I don't think is as true today. So in the eugenics movement, women's unfitness for full citizenship and educational equality were medicalized. The female body and mind were seen as unsuited for education. Edward Clark, author of Sex and Education, or A Fair Chance for Girls, wrote that excessive education caused a series of maladies including, quote, bloodless female faces that suggest consumption, scrofula, anemia, and neuralgia. As with disabled people today, women's social position was treated as a medical problem that necessitated separate and special care. Those who wrote with acknowledged authority on the woman question were doctors. As Clark had, the eugenicist wrote, the answer to the, quote, problem of the women's sphere must be obtained from physiology, not from ethics or metaphysics. And unfortunately, the arguments in response to this often were framed in ableist terms as well. Many suffragists accepted that those with disabilities should not be allowed to vote and focused on arguing that they were not disabled, that it was a slander to call them, to refer to them in that way, and relatedly, that lack of voting rights was itself disabling. While it would be unreasonable to expect these women to theorize and advance the politics of disability ahead of the rest of society, this is the same movement that refused to support the abolition of slavery for opportunistic political calculations as well. So again, I'm not going to go beyond that for the purpose of brevity, but something to consider. Also in the early 1900s was when border enforcement was being established. At the turn of the century, the first immigration laws were passed and each subsequent one restricted immigrants more, based both on race and disability, in an effort to regulate the labor force. As immigrants arrived on boats from Ellis Island, they were examined by inspectors. Here, still, various suppressed identities were mixed together. The main purpose of the examinations was to determine whether the individual was, quote, likely to become a public charge. So no, not just could they work now, but would they continue to be working citizens or not. As one Ellis Island official wrote, feeble-mindedness, that's the term that they use, conveniently served as, quote, a sort of wastebasket for many forms and degrees of weak-mindedness. The emphasis at this point was looking for able-bodied workers. However, they also screened for signs of sexual nonconformity. They actively attempted to weed out queer people with savvy lines of questioning such as, do you want to marry? Do you care for the opposite sex? Have you had acquaintances of the opposite sex? Another example in immigration, despite the fact that the number of Mexicans who died of tuberculosis were almost double that of all other immigrant groups, Mexican male laborers were not regarded as diseased because they were preferred for cheap, dangerous physical labor in that period. On the other hand, high infant mortality rates in Mexican communities were perceived as evidence of Mexican women's ill health, lack of education, and poor parenting skills. In this way, Mexican women were cast as diseased reproducers of unfit citizens and undeserving of the privilege of legal immigration. There's, of course, a lot more to say about disability and race and immigration, but this is about gender and disability, so I'm going to rein myself back in and move on to the fun part, sex. I'm guessing most people here are familiar with the virgin whore dynamic that women so often face. People with disabilities of all genders face a similar dynamic. They're seen as dangerous, hypersexualized perverts, or they're seen as infantilized asexual children. Despite their infantilization, people with disabilities have always actively asserted their sexuality and have fought for more access to resources, supports, and education. This has been a long and ongoing fight. And I think the starting point should be that all people have the right to express themselves sexually as long as this doesn't hurt someone else. That's where the Ashley X case comes in. As I discussed in the beginning, Ashley X was subjected to a series of unnecessary invasive medical procedures to basically, in my opinion, de-sex her. The parents were very vocal about their decision. They have a website, Pillow Angel. Yeah. She gives, honestly, this is not part of my talk. It's not an official position, but it's very creepy in my opinion. Yeah. As Eva Bader Kitte, a disability scholar, beautifully writes about her own profoundly disabled daughter, we try to refrain from referring to Sasha, that's her daughter, as an angel, since that has the unfortunate side effect of edging her out of the human community. To love Sasha as she is, it is of critical importance to us that, unlike an angel, Sasha has a body, and unlike eternal beings, she does age. Especially because it is hard for many to recognize and acknowledge people whose lives are significantly different, we need to reiterate the unqualified humanity of people with serious cognitive disabilities. Ashley's parents claim that this treatment will allow Ashley to be more mobile with her family, to live with her family for longer, and to become less of a to remain less of a physical burden on them. And they also talk about the imagined discomforts that she would have faced as she went through puberty and developed a female reproductive system. Since 2004, at least 100 more children have been subjected to the Ashley treatment. In a situation where this person, you know, clearly could not consent, do the parents have the right to make this decision? Who are they? In my opinion, it is not their right to deny the human experience of aging to their child. And Why shouldn't this be about demanding better technology, resources, nursing care, and devices to allow Ashley, you know, because a lot of it's about the, and you know, as a parent, I understand, you know, and as an occupational therapist who's worked with this kind of population, I mean, it is physically demanding to work with a large person who cannot move themselves. However, we've sent people to the moon. Like, technology's out there. Say that about a lot of things that I don't approve of in terms of technological advances. Anyway. So to me, yes, this is a denial of Ashley's sexual self and of the other, at least 100 children who face this. One environmental factor that's very important is that so many people with disabilities do not live in a private home. And if they do, you know, sometimes they live with family, but they're infantile, you know, so access to privacy is really often non-existent for people with disabilities. So even if they're technically being given some sort of green light to have sex, it's unclear where they're supposed to do it. And that goes even for masturbation. I went to a panel on this topic years ago when I was studying to become an occupational therapist, and I remember one participant discussing how people with intellectual disabilities were often charged with public indecency or otherwise criminalized for performing sex acts in public when they truly just had nowhere else to go. And you can see how that would drive the idea of the sex-crazed, disabled pervert. Perfect. Yes. Okay. So I'm going to assume we all agree here about the importance of appropriate sexual education that acknowledges multiple genders, a broader view of sexuality, and I think that should be a demand for everyone, not, you know, regardless of disability. When people need accommodations and supports to engage in sexual activity, broader ethical issues are raised. So I'm going to quickly go over two things. There's this really great book by Michael Gill called Already Doing It, Intellectual Disability and Sexual Agency, that I highly recommend. Unfortunately, I didn't see it in the Haymarket Room. He talks about a masturbation training program that's often implemented for people with intellectual disability. Unfortunately, it's often only implemented once there's been a quote-unquote problem behavior, which means some sort, you know, masturbation's occurring in public, it's not hygienic, etc. And I don't want to make, this is like a little bit too beyond the topic, but one of the people who are fighting for masturbation training, one leader believes it's appropriate to have like nursing home staff or whatever teach masturbation techniques with hand over hand learning, which for people who are familiar with learning with, you know, teaching with disabilities, the whole idea of, you know, you need real live visuals and, you know, but I think personally, I think that takes a little too far because the question of consent enters. Two, people with physical disabilities have to fight to be seen as sexual beings. And for people with physical disabilities, sex may look very different. Lack of sensation in the traditional erotic areas creates openings to redefine what sexuality is, and you can, like, literally people have created new erogenous zones on their bodies. A lot of people, particularly with physical, well, I should say with acquired physical disabilities, so experienced sex before physical impairment and after, have spoken that after a years-long process that they found sex actually more enjoyable because they had to kind of open up their view of it. Most of the time, for example, individuals who sustain spinal cord injuries, which for anyone who doesn't know, that usually means paralysis to some degree. So anyway, people who sustain spinal cord injuries of all genders are mostly educated, if they get a sexual education at all, on how to get a penis to ejaculate. So for like women, it's like, how do you get your assumed male partners, you know. So in one study, several participants mentioned that they were asked, when they asked their doctor for their birth control after their accident, they were simply told they no longer needed it, implying their sexual lives were over. So if disabled sex is distinct, is it queer? In Privacy, Dependency, and Disagenation Toward a Sexual Culture for People with Intellectual Disabilities, which is an article by Rachel Adams, she says, the sexuality of people with disabilities is queer in that it confounds bourgeois notions about the appropriate settings and circumstances in which intimacy may occur. And like queers, people with disabilities face legal and social barriers to their attempts to express desire and engage in acts of sexual intimacy. However, their experiences differ in that sex often takes place in the context of dependency. So, While we're on this topic, I want to take a little side road to talk about how there's a higher incidence of out trans people in the autistic community. Unfortunately, a lot of the research about this is based on the medical model, and so it's all about looking for genetic links. I don't know that we can, I have a lot of questions about why the incidence is higher, and I don't know that's actually the question to answer. What they have found is that it is true that there's a higher incidence of trans identity in people with autism than the general population, and there's a higher incidence of autism in the trans community. These numbers are limited because not every trans person comes out and not every autistic person gets a diagnosis. So does this mean that people with autism are more likely to be trans? I don't think that it's answered definitively. It probably can't when there's still trans and disability oppression. Is it because people with autism have a different interaction with social norms and are therefore less beholden to their assigned sex? But as I said, I don't know that why is the most important question to focus on. One thing I want to say about it, though, is that when it comes to kids with autism, obviously their education is just as gendered as their neurotypical peers, and that's why we need to fight for a more gender-neutral approach to childhood in general. And for people who come out as trans, therapists and healthcare providers, I mean, there's a way of wording it, like they should be on the lookout for autistic traits, like it's, you know, like hunting or whatever. But I do think that an adult diagnosis of autism does help certain individuals get the supports they need to be a happier and more fulfilled human being. To me, though, there is a danger that in embracing this correlation and looking at ways to use it both to fight oppression and build solidarity between these two overlapping communities, that we fall into a medical approach to either or both. For example, in looking at this correlation, I came across this theory. Did people know about it? The extreme male brain theory?
Yeah.
So basically, this guy, Simon Baron Cohen, argues that men are better systemizers, more interested in patterns, and quicker to spot them in natural, mathematical, or mechanical systems, and that women are better empathizers, more keenly attuned to the emotional state of others. And he argues that men and women with autism are both better at systemizing than empathizing. He suggests that autism is related to overexposure to testosterone while in the womb. And, you know, this just relies on so much bad science about whether there is a male or female brain, about empathy in people with autism, which is, I think, a really problematic approach to autism, and obviously can lead to very, very problematic ideas about cure, right? About, you know, if we're talking about testosterone in the womb, like what kind of treatments are they going to start selling to pregnant women? It's, you know, et cetera. So in reading these theories, I think there is a big tendency at least in the academic work that I was looking through, to say that people with disabilities are queer because they don't express their gender in the same ways because of their disability or sex lives, et cetera. I think that while it's a way of reaching out an arm in solidarity and saying that, yes, the queer fight shares a lot with the fight for disability rights, I'm not convinced that just saying all of disability is queer is the best approach. What makes more sense to me is to say, one, there are people with all sorts of disabilities who also identify as queer in some way, and they should not experience any extra oppression. They should be supported in every way that it makes sense. And two, that a significant aspect of the oppression that people with disabilities face is issues of sexuality. So this takes us to the issue of consent, and then we'll go to sexual abuse. Many people with intellectual and psychiatric disabilities are deemed unfit to consent for sexual activity. Michael Gill, in that The Already Doing It book, points out that it matters how we talk about the right to consent of individuals with intellectual disability. If we say they're just mentally children with no right to consent, it denies them their sexuality and, in a broader sense, their personhood. Consent for people with intellectual disabilities is further complicated because on top of consent, there's the issue of power dynamics that might not be clear to the victim of the abuse. This is the case, surely, for instances of staff abuse, incest, etc. But in attempting to protect people with intellectual disabilities, often guardians deny this population the right to risk. Sex and romance is a risky game for everyone, and the idea that we can shelter the intellectually disabled population is as unrealistic as it is for anyone else, and unfair. Gill talks about this case of Kaylee MacArthur that I spoke about in my introduction to illustrate the complexities of gender, disability, and consent. She's an 18-year-old high school student, well, she was 18 at the time, that was, according to the law, she was assaulted. And, you know, it's very hard to say that you could just see two parallel versions of the story, one where it was consensual and one where it wasn't. She was never given a voice to speak about it. She did not speak in the trial. It was only her parents versus Robert Harris, the defendants. And the defense point painted the encounter as a gender-affirming sexual awakening for Kaylee, while the prosecution implied sexual activity was itself corrupting, that she become more aggressive sexually. So both kind of sexist approaches to talking about this young woman's sexuality. Another point that came into it was about the power dynamics. The power dynamics, but also why Kaylee's disability was amplified while Robert's was silenced. I forget if I said this, but he was diagnosed and was being treated for depression by the end of the trial. As Gill quotes another scholar, Razak, women with intellectual disabilities are often subjected not only to experiences of sexual abuse and assault, but simultaneously rendered incompetent to participate in sexual relations. By extension, all or almost all sexual activities are automatically assumed to be assault. They have to be proven otherwise in criminal and legal mechanisms. As such, sexual, quote unquote, virtue has to be claimed. In these cases, we need to uphold women with intellectual disabilities' right to be sexual when defending them from sexual abuse. So unfortunately, I'm going to end this section with the worst news. Sexual abuse statistics are very depressing. People with intellectual disabilities are believed to be 7 times as likely to be sexually abused as the general population. All people with disabilities are abused 3.5 times more than people without. And women with intellectual disabilities experience at the highest rates 5 times more likely than a man with intellectual disabilities. I didn't have time. I was cutting things ruthlessly from this talk. I don't have time to talk about some of the stories, but people can raise them and I can tell you some in the conclusion, although it's a depressing way to end too. But I wanna say that, you know, when the Me Too movement busted things open last year, people with disabilities didn't necessarily receive the most public attention, but they did speak out and say Me Too. It definitely stirred things up. And I think there are two tacks that we can take that are necessary to address rape culture today. One is taking abusers on head on and also asserting everyone's personhood. I'm all for sex education, really, truly I am, but I think that sometimes the whole idea that people with intellectual disabilities need sex education to prevent sexual assault sounds a lot like saying how women need to change how they dress. We should have a zero tolerance policy for victim blaming. The oppression and the driving of people with disabilities and women into the private sphere of the home and out of the workforce means that they are seen as less than in the society, more easily disposed, and therefore more easily abused. So we have to take on the system, not just sexual education or those things. Although again, sexual education is very important for everybody. A movement that asserts the personhood of people with disabilities as well as women and queer folk is a necessary component of fighting that rape culture. And also, one thing on sex education too is that it's also one of the reasons it's so necessary for everyone is because it can help prevent the abusers from abusing, right? Like, actually, everyone is taught about consent and what's, you know, a broader view of sex. And so, the last thing I'm going to be speaking about is reproductive justice. One dynamic you'll notice is that disability turns all the reproductive rules for cis women on their head. Whereas I would have a very, very hard time trying to get a tubal ligation in this country today. It is pushed on people with disabilities, especially people with intellectual disabilities. And while getting an abortion is harder and harder for people without disabilities, my read is that people with disabilities are strongly encouraged to abort if they do get pregnant. When abortion and sterilization don't work, people with disabilities have their kids stolen from them by the child welfare system. Thousands of people with disabilities were sterilized against their will in the 20th century. Starting with a 1907 Indiana law, at least 30 other states passed legislation mandating sterilization. The model law designed by eugenicist Harry Laughlin, that's how you pronounce it, defined socially inadequate classes of people very broadly. So it included queer people. the famous Supreme Court case in 1927, which I won't say much about, but just it was the case of Carrie Buck, and it upheld sterilization laws, and the case has never been formally overturned. The judge famously, that's the case for people who, it's kind of ringing a bell, that the judge famously said, quote, three generations of imbeciles are enough. However, today's sterilization still happens, but more on a case-by-case basis, often at the request of legal guardians. In Montreal, there's a whole movement of parents of people with intellectual disabilities to have their adult children sterilized so they can be safely sexually active. We don't know how many of those individuals really came to that decision independently, what it seems like is the parents spend a course of years convincing them to do it. In the fall of 2011, the Massachusetts Department of Mental Health filed a petition to have the parents of a woman with psychiatric disability appointed as temporary guardians for the purpose of consenting to an abortion. This is how hard the court wanted this, how much the court wanted this abortion, despite the fact that the woman was refusing. The court ordered that the woman's parents be appointed and that she could be, quote, coaxed, bribed, or even enticed by ruse into a hospital where she would be sedated and an abortion would be performed. Shocking, considering how hard it is to get an abortion in this country. The judge also ordered that the judge also ordered the facility that performed the abortion to sterilize the woman to avoid this painful situation from recurring in the future. Luckily, the woman did win, and this did not occur, but I just found it pretty shocking that a court would go so far to try to get an abortion. So, moving right along, let's talk about parenting a disability. ACS is only too trigger happy to remove children from families in which the parents have a disability. 37 states plus Washington, D.C. allow disability as grounds for termination of parental rights. Removal rates where parents have a psychiatric disability have found to be as high as 70 to 80%. Where the parent has an intellectual disability, the rates range from 40 to 80%. In families where the parental disability is physical, 13% have reported pathologically discriminatory treatment in custody cases. The deaf and blind communities also report very high rates of child removal and loss of parental rights. The issue is that any doctor can report the birth, and then, anybody in a hospital really, and then it's up to the parents to prove their fitness, not on the government to prove their unfitness. And I am a parent, I can test. People think they can just tell you how to parent. I don't know why. Do you know why? I guess it doesn't matter, they still do it. But for parents with disabilities, it is of course much more extreme. Beyond the constant fear that someone will call ACS on you, random people come up to you and tell you, why are you holding your baby? Who let you have it? Things like, useful comments like that. And then, you can just imagine how scary it would be asking for help, accommodations, or support as a parent if you think that your baby could be taken away at any time. And I'll just make a plug, but there's a parenting podcast called The Longest Shortest Hour, and there was a recent episode called How to Hear a Smile, where she talks to a blind parent about her experience, and she talks about the fear in the hospital even after picking her OBGYN and picking a hospital and trying to like set herself up, how scared she was that in the moments after delivering her baby, which any woman who's done it knows it's a little bit disorienting, that someone would take her son away. So let's go back to that case of Sharon DeChesno and Candace McCullough, the lesbian couple, vilified for not actively preventing the birth of another deaf child. The whole sperm bank, the way it was really funny, like commuting home, Googling, like, what are the qualifications to donate sperm? Because, it's such a like story on all the TV and movies, men are just like, oh, I'll make a few bucks. But it's actually vetted and, quite intensely. Not so easy to become a sperm donor, and you can just imagine if getting a sperm donation is difficult, how difficult adoption is for people with disabilities, and I don't have time to talk more about it. I have intentionally not discussed pregnancy much since there's a whole discussion about it on Sunday, but I want to just end the section about reproductive justice with one comment about pregnancy and abortion. The question of prenatal testing and choosing to abort on the basis of suspected or confirmed impairment of the fetus is, I think, an important one. And while I hear the concerns of some disability rights activists about the way this can be interpreted and the ableist language and the way the recommendations are made, I think given today's conditions, given the healthcare system, the lack of parental leave, the lack of education, funding, the marginalization and poor treatment of people with disabilities, the only person I trust to make that decision is a pregnant person. If, as I've been arguing, we should be fighting for autonomy for all people, regardless of impairment, then that's true for women as well. And I don't see the case for anyone besides a pregnant person making that decision. In fact, opinions on abortion in the US, and I think this can be read, there's problematic aspects to this, but also important aspects to this. Real quickly, one of the ways that mainstream opinion on abortion changed in the early 1960s, just before the rise of the women's movement, was after an epidemic of rubella, also known as the German measles. Like, do people remember the Zika outbreak a few years ago? Similar thing, where if you caught it in your first trimester, it could cause blindness, deafness, physical cognitive impairments, and death for the baby. At the time, abortion was illegal except when deemed medically necessary, and so hospitals had special committees and they would determine whether women who had been exposed to rubella had the right to abortion, which was of course a race and class, there was a heavy race and class component of who ended up getting it, but it was on the cover of Time magazine, and it really, the picture of middle class women with wanted pregnancies with this choice of what to do if they, you know, they weren't sure if they'd been exposed, etc., changed the narrative about abortion and is one of the reasons I think we have legal abortion today. So I think we need to raise the issues about disability in the feminist movement and argue for building solidarity when hopefully everything I've laid out indicates that potential. And I think we can talk about those kind of ableist terms and the prenatal testing and all of that with in the feminist movement. I think, you know, it's important, but I don't think there's, but I think in the end we have to trust women. And we also have to trust disabled people to make decisions for their bodies as well, right? And like that's hopefully what I've been saying, what this talk has led us to. So just to conclude real quickly, there's so many demands that we could be making. But I will say, I think given the Me Too movement over the last year, there's a real opening around rape culture and sexual abuse. And so I think, and I hope people can speak in this room about the ways that we can bring together the LGBTQ movement, the women's movement, and the disability rights movement on the questions of sexual abuse, on asserting our personhood in a way that can both take down abusers, make the world a safer place, and raise all these other issues that come along. There are always, you know, people who want to box these movements in. I didn't get to speak too much about it. There's a lot of instances of the women's movement using ableist language, separating themselves from the disabled community. But I think it's up to us as socialists and Marxists to argue for those common links, to argue for why we can join and fight, and to fight for a better, more accessible world. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.